Welcome to the conference. Please note today's call is being recorded. Please stand by.
Hello, everyone. Good morning and welcome to the Cost and Resource Use Measure Question and Answer Call. My name is Evan Williamson, the project manager. I'm joined in the room today by Ann Phillips, project analyst. On the phone as well, we have Ashley Wilbon, managing director for performance measurement, and Tarun Amin, senior director for performance measurement. At this time, we'd like to take a roll call of the committee members. I know this is an optional Q&A call, and we have another one scheduled on February 19th, so I'm not going to run through the entire roster. But if you are a committee member, if you could please identify yourself, we'll make sure that we write that down to make sure we know that you are on the call. So do we have any committee members on the call right now?
Carolyn Perry.
Hi, Carolyn.
Hi.
Clark.
Marianne?
Yes.
Okay, great. We didn't hear the first part of that. It was great. Welcome. Anybody else?
Thank you.
Andrea Gelser.
Hi, Andrea.
Hi.
Hi, this is Thomas Fang from Merck.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good.
Hi, this is Andy Ryan.
Hi, Andy. How are you doing?
Fine, thanks.
Great. Do we have anybody else? All right, great. Do we have any representatives of our measure developers on the line?
Hi, it's Nancy Kim from Yale Core.
Hi, Nancy. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
And this is Ben Hamlin from NCQA.
Hi, Ben. Welcome.
Thank you.
Great. So, again, we'll reiterate the purpose for these calls is really to give the committee members an opportunity to ask questions of NQF staff about the review process, of the measure developers about the, any questions they've come into so far when reviewing the measure documents. They can ask questions of each other about the review process so far. So, again, this is really kind of a just an opportunity to open it up where we want to really provide that opportunity as you review these measures to really get all your questions answered. And it'll help also raise issues for the developers to address as we move into our in-person meeting in March. So at this point, we'll open it up to the developers. We have screen sharing set, or open up to the committee members, I'm sorry. We have screen sharing set up, so we'll be able to pull up the relevant documents from our site. We have our review, our measure evaluation criteria, and then the actual specifications documents, just in case we need to refer back to anything. So this time, we'll open it up for any questions from the committee. Okay, so we're not hearing any questions so far. Let's see, let's think about what would be most helpful now.
Hi, Evan, this is Ashley.
Yep.
I guess I would just ask the committee, I guess for those that are on the call so far, has everyone been able to access the documents on SharePoint okay? And also, there was something, some additional materials that we provided that's somewhat new. It was a staff review of the measure where staff went through and reviewed the measure and provided kind of some summary comments and tried to point out some things, some questions for the committee to focus on based on staff's initial assessment of the measure. So to those that have had an opportunity to review the document, or maybe that document in particular, just any feedback you have on the utility of that, whether or not that has helped your review of the measure, or just in general kind of orienting yourself to the survey process, which for those of you that have returned on the committee from last time, it is a little bit different than the process we use to collect your initial evaluations of the measure. So anything along those lines is definitely fair game. And we're interested in hearing your input, not only on the measures, but kind of about the processes. We're, as you guys know, we're implementing a lot of process improvements. So input you have on, how it's been so far would be useful as well.
Thanks a lot, Ashley. So up on the webinar now for screen sharing. I've brought up the committee SharePoint page here. So again, we can walk through any of that if you have anything that you want to comment on that Ashley just brought up.
Evan, this is Andy Ryan, and yep. Would it be appropriate to ask a kind of a question to the Mezzer developer to maybe anticipate an issue that may arise in the actual review process?
Absolutely. I believe that's definitely in scope for this call.
Okay. So, hi. I'm sorry. I'm not sure if I got I got the name right for the Yale developer who was on the call with the readmission measures.
Is that Nancy?
No, it's Nancy. But my question has to do with the validity of the heart failure measure. And, you know, there's been a lot that's been out in the literature about, you know, how valid these measure the readmission is for the medical conditions, and I think, you know, the question of validity and getting the right yardstick to say, okay, this is correlated with things that other measures of quality that we think are important. I mean, it's kind of looking at the cup half empty or half full, and people kind of disagree about what the literature says. I'm just kind of curious what the kind of general argument is going to be, if you're willing to share it, about, you know, the why, what's the kind of assertion based on the evidence that this, the readmission measures have sufficient validity to merit you know, approval by NQF through this process.
Can anyone hear me? It's Nancy Kim.
We can hear you now.
Oh, okay, good. I just want to make sure we're talking about the correct measure. I am the lead on the heart failure payment, episode of care payment. Is that the mm-hmm. measure that you're asking about, Andy?
Yes.
And your question is, how do payments correlate to quality?
Yes.
So that's an excellent question. Both AMI and the heart failure payment measures were constructed to be aligned with our heart failure and AMI quality measures. In and of themselves, the payment measures are exactly that, payment measures, but they are meant to be paired with the quality measures to illuminate value. Does that answer your question?
And what could you describe the state of the you know, I reviewed the materials closely, but how could you describe the analyses you've done that where you evaluate correlations between the payment measures and the other quality measures?
Sure. I mean, the payment measure itself is just the payment measure. We have done supplementary analyses that are not part of the payment measure that look at how the payment measures correlate with quality, specifically both the AMI 30-day mortality measure and the heart failure 30-day mortality measure. More work is done in the AMI arena. And I know you're asking more about heart failure. And because it's a 30-day measure, both for payments and for mortality, we don't find a terrifically high correlation between how hospitals appear on their 30-day episode of care payment and their 30-day mortality measure, but that I just want to remind the committee is this is just the payment piece of that. This is
right.
not a value measure. This is the development of the payment methodology.
Right. And so what about other broad measures of healthcare spending beyond, you know, the 30-day window and for different types of spending? What has your analysis of the 30-day heart failure payment, you know, what are the other cost measures that it correlates most closely with and might be less correlated with.
Are you asking how our 30-day heart failure measure compares to other measures?
Yes.
We have not looked at that specifically.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if somebody from NQF wants to respond to that.
Ashley Tarun, would you want to respond to that?
I'm not sure. This is Ashley. I'm not sure exactly from the NQF perspective what there might be to add, except that, and Andy was on the committee before, but I think the unique aspect of this, these measures kind of being linked to quality is something that, linked to a quality measure that we can identify is something that's new, and it might be a little challenging, but I guess the focus, obviously, of the measure evaluation is going to be on the cost measure. But I would anticipate, because that link has been explicitly stated, that that could be, as Andy is alluding to, an issue that the committee will want to kind of understand and learn more about, particularly as it may be related to how validity was demonstrated in terms of, you know, correlations with other measures of quality. So not sure if that answers the question or complicates things, but happy to expound more if needed.
I guess this one question has there been any analysis to assess the correlation between the cost in the 30-day window versus cost in other post-discharge windows?
Not specifically in preparation for this. That is an evaluation that we have planned for what we call measure maintenance. That's happening currently, but we haven't really planned. We have not done analyses to support this measure.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, this is Janice Orlowski. I have a few questions.
Hi, Janice. Yeah, go ahead.
Hi. Just a couple of things. One is I tried to speak via the web link and wasn't able to, so I don't know if that's supposed to be a capability or not. I also heard that you asked the question of were there any problems with the SharePoint, and I would my comment is that it was very easy to use, so I appreciate that. As a new committee member, I might have some questions that you might have to help me with just to get rolling. But sticking with 2436, which is the 30-day episode of a care for heart failure, I have two concerns. One is how do you distinguish those hospitals or care events that are associated heading towards a left ventricular assist device or a transplant program where they may have significantly different resource utilization for those patients as opposed to those that are in the hospital with the diagnosis of heart failure but have no intention to proceed to a program?
Thank you for that question. It's Nancy Kim from Yale Corps. We exclude those who have heart transplant or LVAD on their index admission or during their 30-day episode of care payment window.
So is that really enough? Because often people will come into the hospital with heart failure and will be worked up and placed on the transplant list but may not be transplanted for a significant period of time but may come back for further workup. So are you really able to distinguish those individuals?
We haven't done more supplementary analyses. Do you have a suggestion to identify those individuals of concern? We have not done that, to answer your question directly.
Mm-hmm.
We do plan to exclude those with a history of LVAD or heart transplant.
Right, but if they don't have a history, if it's a prospective mm-hmm. planned procedure, mm-hmm. I think that we have to be able to separate those folks out.
Okay. I appreciate that comment. We haven't done that, and I will also say that our heart transplant and LVAD exclusions were quite small. It was 0.04% of our cohort for LVAD on the index for the 30-day window and 0.05% of our cohort for heart transplant, but I appreciate your comment.
Yeah. I think that certainly if someone is listed or going to be listed for a transplant, that we would, that there's a mechanism to identify those individuals. If there is an anticipation of a medication trial, then followed by a device, I don't know that you'd be able to identify them unless you look at subsequent admissions. So if you see someone who 6 months later or 12 months later has a device, I think that it affects their earlier resource utilization. So I don't know if there's a opportunity to look backwards in that respect. And that's sort of off the top of my head. I could think of, try to think of some other opportunities.
Yeah, again, I appreciate that comment because LVADs are being used more commonly as time goes on, as you well know. But we are limited by our CMS claims data.
Mm-hmm.
And because of the sheer volume, we really like to limit the amount of data that we look at. What you're common is just one data.
My other comment with 2436 is I believe that there is often confusion between heart failure and end-stage renal disease with fluid overload. And I believe that end-stage renal disease with fluid overload often either due to misdialysis or noncompliance with fluid restrictions, I see those often getting confused in the hospital. And so, for example, if you look at the CMS bundle on heart failure, if you go through that, it can often be tainted, so to speak, with ESRD patients with fluid overload because the coding doesn't distinguish between the two of them. And I think that they're two very different events that occur. And to look at left ventricular function or to do any of the other parameters with ESRD and fluid overload is probably wrong from a medical care point of view. So I look at them as two different types of diagnosis, and I would actually exclude ESRD with fluid overload unless the physician clearly believes that there's an element of heart failure with it.
Hi, it's Nancy Kim from Yale Corps. Thanks for that comment. That's not currently an explicit exclusion. We identify our cohort using the ICD-9 codes that I'm sure you read in our materials. But thanks for that thought.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks a lot, Janet. I just want to comment on the webinar capabilities. So the webinar, we do stream the webinar, but that doesn't allow interacting with the...
It doesn't. Okay, thanks.
So we... streaming is only for people who want to listen in on the webinar but not be available to speak. So just a
perfect
clarification. Yeah.
Thanks for that clarification. And right now what I'm seeing on the webinar is the agenda and not the SharePoint, although you had mentioned that you were going to put the SharePoint up.
Let me go back to that because I'm in the room here. I'm sharing the brief measure information for 2436, and I guess let me make sure that...
And I was going to say, and I'm not seeing it, maybe others are on the web link, but just for your information.
You may want to try refreshing your browser.
Will do.
And that may help kind of update you.
So my next question is with 1558. And I have three questions with that. My first is, as we take a look at the procedure codes that are included, there is a procedure code for carotid endarterectomy. But there are not other peripheral vascular disease intervention codes included. And I was wondering why with coronary artery disease there would be a carotid code included but not the other peripheral disease codes.
So this has been from NCQA. I'm not exactly sure what you're talking about in the inclusion criteria. There are other, in the value set list that was provided, there are other peripheral vascular disease codes that are included. The carotid, I think, is particularly called out because it's one of the frequency of service categories for the measure, so I'm not sure which section of the measure you're looking in, because we separate that out as a specific frequency of service per member per year for each plan.
I let me just look at this and see if I can bring you to that. So your intention with 1558 is to measure cardiovascular disease, including all of the peripheral vascular interventions?
Pretty much anyone who meets our definition for ischemic vascular disease is included in the measure, and that's the inclusion. And then what we do is we look at the relative resource use for that entire population over the entire year. We don't try and associate specific services, to cardiovascular disease specifically. We just look at, again, in the identified population. As part of that, though, we do break out certain procedures, commonly performed procedures in this population, and the carotid is one of them, CABG is another, and those are reported as a per member per year frequency of service alongside all of the resource use information. So the carotid is included and priced in the resource use side under the standard pricing tables, but it's also included as a frequency of service number.
I see. So you are just looking at that the carotid particularly, but you don't mean to exclude the other vascular procedure.
No. Right. No, they're definitely included in the identification of the population, and again, some of them are also included as under the frequency, CABG, cardiac CT, carotid endarterectomy, a number of those are under the frequency categories as well. So there's a lot of different subcomponents to the measure, and so I just wanted to make sure you were looking at the right part, or I was telling you the right answer to the right part.
I think that I was looking at the summary, which just called out the carotid endarterectomy, but I do see it now.
Okay.
And did you also
include? Sorry, go ahead.
Did you also, besides peripheral vascular, do you also include renal artery procedures?
The procedures, I'm not sure of. I'd have to see if I can call up the value set list. Most of it. There are some renal diagnoses, but the procedures, I am not sure those are included in the identification. Let me try and pull up the value set list here.
This is John Randolph. I'd just like to do a follow-up question to move through this.
Sure, you can keep asking. I'll keep looking.
John, go ahead.
So you're triggering based on procedures for cerebrovascular disease, not just cardiovascular, since you're looking at carotids for 1558?
To get into the measure, yes, there are a series of diagnoses sort of under the ischemic vascular disease umbrella that will get you in, either procedures, if you have an AMI or a CABG or some PCI procedure in the year prior to the measurement year, or a diagnosis of IVD, and there's a sort of a list of values that are included under that that will get you into the eligible population. We don't...
So without digging through your ICD-9s, you use carotid endarterectomy as a trigger. Do you use stroke that's medically treated or a cerebrovascular event that's not treated with a carotid endarterectomy as a trigger as well? Or are you just bringing in stroke patients that had endarterectomies?
Just bringing in those who have a diagnosis associated with some sort of ischemic ischemic diagnosis are the eligible population. We don't generally include procedures as an identification. Like I said, in this case, certain PCI procedures are included as long as the patient had them in a year prior, because we're using our standard definition for IVD, which is across a number of different measures. It's the definition because of cardiovascular conditions that we use. And it's because of the way claims works. We sort of have to go to that two-year definition.
Can I ask one more procedural question while I have the floor? Probably more for NQF.
Sure.
1558 is a more... I thought it was a relatively mature measure, or something that's been out there. the point for this re-review is?
Yes, this is Evan. Our measures go through what we call measure maintenance. So after a measure has been endorsed, within 3 years, we bring them through a maintenance process where they go under the review again.
So the point's not expanding the scope of the measure or changing the measure. This is just a routine re-review of 1558?
Yes. I mean, we do ask some additional information about the measure in use on our forms for our maintenance measures, but this isn't you know, a material change to the measure or something of that nature. It's more along the lines. This is our standard process for reviewing measures in our portfolio.
Thank you.
Evan, following up on that, and this is Joe Stefanski. I'm sorry for joining late.
Oh, no problem.
In a three-year period, there often can be some tweaks to a measure. And so I guess what I'm interested in when we see a measure coming up for a re-endorsement process, some summary of any changes in the measure itself, even if they're minor, and any changes in the science underlying the measure that might be pertinent.
Yes. Let me actually, Ashley Tarun, do you want to expand upon our maintenance process? I mean, I'll try to pull some information here, but we do ask some questions about the measure in use and the maintenance process. Let me.
Yes. So this is Ashley. Yeah. This is Ashley Joe. I think that's a really good point. I think our process for collecting information on maintenance measures has been pretty standard, and we're always looking for ways to improve. But I think you bring up a good point, as we have standing committees that have reviewed measures, like the same measure, you know, before in the past, that it might be useful to have a way of kind of collecting the information about the measure of specifically what's changed or what's different since the last submission in a more succinct way. So that's a point very well taken. And I would probably just ask Ben if there's a, you know, if he's able to kind of maybe point out a few things, if there's anything that has changed that he thinks might be valuable for the committee to know.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So I wanted to answer the older question first. If you're interested in the list of IVD diagnoses that we use for the elderly population,
mm-hmm.
it can be found starting on page 91 of the clinical logic PDF that was included in the measure form.
Great, thank
so
you.
Just there's the sort of long list of ICD-9 primarily. We have now posted also ICD-10 in corollary, and I did not include those because those are only being initiated this year upcoming. So that was one of the changes that we've done. We've mapped everything in all of our measures from ICD-9 to ICD-10. For our measures as well, as far as our standard pricing tables, those get updated every 3 years. However, every year we do apply a minor cost adjustment that's based in the CMS Medicare data. So we try and keep the standard prices that we use for our resource use relatively up to date. The other thing that we did actually add this year were two new service categories. So one of the things that we test before we include services in our relative resource use measures is we look for reliability and consistency in the coding of the claims to ensure that if we're including services in our standard pricing tables, that they're as accurate as possible, given the nature of administrative claims. And we were able to add diagnostic laboratory and diagnostic imaging as two new service categories in the relative resource use measures. So the resources used under those specific categories are now included as separate reported out for our resource use. So that was the biggest change. Pretty much everything else, the risk adjustment is still the same. Apart from sort of the coding updates over the last couple of years, those have remained fairly consistent. The other thing we did do was we actually removed for this measure and for the diabetes measure the mandatory ESRD exclusion. Previously we had anyone with active cancer, HIV, ESRD, were automatically excluded from the measure because we had concerns about the cost. Managing those patients costs a lot, and we were afraid that certain plans who had many ESRD patients would be capping out their resources use. So we went back in after a couple of years of data collection and looked at that specifically to see if that was the case because of concerns from the initial review of NQF saying, ESRD is really kind of a critical component of cardiovascular conditions and diabetes. And we found that it didn't really skew the results so much that would so we decided to remove that as a mandatory exclusion. So active cancer and HIV are still automatic exclusions from the measure category because of the costs associated with treating those patients, but ESRD has now been removed. So ESRD, patients with ESRD categories are now included in the measure of resource use for these patients. So those are the three major changes we had since the initial review.
Yeah, good. That helps with
your risk adjustment over the time course, or have you learned anything about relative risk adjustment with wider use of 1558?
Well, we've, you know, so we use a CMS HCC risk adjustment approach, and we do an annual analysis looking at the correlations between the service categories and the specific risk cohorts, how this is reported out. We sort of look for trends in those correlations between services and the patient types and the risk adjustment model. Because we only get aggregate data at NCQA from the HEDIS reporting, mm-hmm. it's a lot of aggregate data, but it's not patient level. We don't go back in and retest the risk adjustment specifically for each of these cohorts. We rely on the HCC to be, CMS to sort of keep the model up to date, if you will. We originally tested it for appropriateness for these measures, but we have not done any specific testing on the risk adjustment.
Thanks.
Ashley, this is Joe Stefanski again with a.
Hi.
This is a question that you may have already covered because I joined late. As I look at the Yale measures, the CMS measures for CHF and AMI, and the idea of linking together both this particular resource use measure with the mortality and the readmissions measure, and I assume we're going to see the pneumonia side of this soon. Probably in front of this committee on the resource use side. We've already had the technical experts look at the clinical side in both the mortality and the readmissions measure, and now we're kind of looking at it again. I guess the thing that worries me a little bit is if we find, or as a group or a substantial portion of the group that finds a problem with the clinical logic, we really are talking about having to go back and review those other associated measures to make them useful for what we're going to want in terms of what's coming up next, linking quality and cost.
Yeah.
This is really a funny evaluation in a way, considering we're not just affecting this measure, but we have ripple effects.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very good point. And we'll actually be having a discussion with the committee at the in-person meeting, something to this effect, as we kind of move towards the standing committee somewhat taking ownership over a portfolio of measures and seeing how getting an idea of how measures are related to one another in the cost area and where that responsibility should lie in terms of reviewing and the impact that it may have by having measures kind of parsed out by, under review from different groups. So we'll talk a little bit about that. In terms of kind of the process that we have right now, obviously we kind of have to go forward with where we are in terms mm-hmm. of reviewing what we have in front of us, taking the input, and providing that feedback back to the developers. We'll have to kind of see how that goes. It's hard to say right now how that might impact, but I think it's a very good point, and it'll be definitely be something that's on our radars as we move forward.
I have a tendency to, and this is a personal bias, to probably look at the measure details with a little less critical eye because I want to see that the multiple measures work together. Mm-hmm. That may not be a good bias to have in this case. I don't know. But, I recognize it, but I'm not sure exactly how it's going to affect how I look at these.
Yeah, and I think it will balance out. We did have a clinical group look at the measures, and obviously there are a lot of clinicians on this committee, this standing committee as well. So I think, the purpose of having a lot of people with different backgrounds and different expertise is that, people will
focus on different parts of the measures because of their expertise and for various reasons. So I think that will all balance itself out. We'll kind of have to see where we land when the group convenes to see what concerns there may be. Our TEP that we convened for the review of these measures last week, I believe.
Yeah.
So we'll be compiling a summary of those, of that input this week, and hopefully distributing that to you by the end of the week. So you'll have an idea of kind of where they landed on some things. And again, there are several clinicians on this committee as well. So that should give you a good idea of what issues there may be to discuss.
Well, I did listen in on the TEP call.
Oh, okay, great.
And then that was pretty straightforward. I was concerned about, as I said before, changes in science that might have showed up that I needed to know about. But that was pretty straightforward, I think.
Okay, great.
Ashley, this is Andy. On the same point, so 2158 is a payment standardized Medicare spending for beneficiary. And, there was a different developer on that. And, these AMI and CHF measures are basically a subset of that larger measure. And so, did NQF give specific instructions with respect to harmonizing with that measure? Or is this because... how I'm just kind of wondering what the instructions, trying to anticipate what this is going to look like for the committee, given that there's already, a larger measure that in some sense already subsumes these measures that we're going to consider.
Yeah, that's a great question. We did have some calls early on with the developers. This was back actually before the phase that just ended, about a year ago, kind of about how all of these measures fit together. And I do think that although we didn't focus, I think the assumption, and I'll kind of throw this out to Tarun if he's able to comment on, the assumption was based on our conversations with them that they were built they were already built in to kind of be harmonized. That was already kind of built into their development process. Although I will, with the developers on the call, I'd probably like to throw that out to them just to confirm, but I don't think we were as concerned with the harmonization within this group of measures as we were kind of with other measures from different, when I say different developers, I'm meaning the outside of CMS, not necessarily their subcontractors, but outside of CMS. So I think, again, just in case that was confusing, I think we were less concerned with the harmonization within this group of measures, this related group of measures from CMS, as we were with other measures. And my understanding was that they were, as they were built, that harmonization was kind of inherent in them, in the way they're conceptualized. But I can obviously hand that over to Yale. The developers have some insight on that to offer.
Hi, can you hear me? It's Nancy Kim.
Yes.
Am I on, or did I?
Yeah.
On me. Okay.
We can hear you.
Okay, good. Thanks. I think Ashley's right. We had a number of calls over the development phase over the last year and a half. And I think we did land exactly where she said. We harmonized where we could, but because ours is condition-specific, as you point out, meant to be paired with the AMI and heart failure 30-day risk standardized mortality rate, that we serve a slightly different purpose and that there's benefit to having both measures.
And that's definitely certainly something we can have a larger discussion about with the committee when you guys come in person to see how these all fit together.
Yeah, this is Joe Stefanski again. Yeah, I think that actually that they're lining up quite nicely. I am a little bit concerned. Well, partially what I see is, NQF staff, you guys are already running at Redline. I'm going to guess the Yale developers are already running at Redline, and there's not a lot of resources or time left to clean everything up. And we have to have a little bit of tolerance and help each other out on this. I did notice a few places, for example, in the CMS Yale documents, where there were some probably in contradictions and they were just simply errors in areas where it looked like the different developers, say, from the readmissions measures to the cost side of it, didn't really understand each other's measures that well. phrases like that the readmission measure was based on admission date. Things like that tells me that, that these groups may not be sitting down together as much as might be desired. But overall, I think it's gone pretty well.
Great. Thanks, Joe. Do we have any other questions?
All right. Joe, again, just thinking ahead as to where we're going to run into some potential problems. Not that the measures need to be changed at this point, but we got to think about it because we're dealing with hospital stays that are often very short, which means we are dealing now with how RAC audits may affect an inpatient or an inpatient status. The audit itself may throw it back into the outpatient side, and I'm not sure how those are being picked up because they can affect the cost measure in quite a few ways. And the other thing we've got to think about is what's going on with observation status and this two-midnight rule that eventually will get implemented here, which I think is going to introduce some administrative noise to these measures.
John Ratliff here. So CMS faced some pretty stiff pushback about the two-midnight decision.
Mm-hmm.
To my knowledge, they've kind of backed off of that at present. They're sort of reassessing how they're going to define an inpatient admission, since that goes to the whole point. There's like no clear definition that hospitals have to work from CMS with regards to what inpatient versus outpatient is. At the RUC, we use one definition. Apparently CMS isn't quite happy with that definition. But to my knowledge, it's kind of still up in the air.
I think there's been a six-month postponement in enforcement. But one way or another, the whole issue between inpatient and observation status, again, could, whatever happens with these rules, could introduce administrative noise that doesn't have anything to do with the clinical treatment of the patients.
I completely agree with that. But in my experience, I'm not good at predicting what CMS does. So I might have to wait and kind of see how CMS responds to this. But
yeah.
I hear your point, and I think it's extremely valid, because that may throw a monkey wrench into a number of these measures. It's almost like we have to kind of wait and see what CMS does, perhaps build in a bit of flexibility to allow for anticipated changes. But otherwise, we're kind of...
I do think that the heart failure one in particular could be dramatically affected because someone could come in florid pulmonary edema, be in the ICU, be diuresed over a day, may or may not be intubated, and be out within 48 hours. And if all of those go to a two-midnight rule, it would dramatically change the payments associated with that kind of an episode. So I think what you're bringing up is very timely.
I don't think we need to worry about making any adjustments in the measures now, but particularly since we're heading for standing committees looking over these areas, that we just need to keep this stuff in the background and watch for impacts.
Thanks a lot, Joe. We've definitely taken that down. We've set aside some time during our agenda, during our in-person meeting to really kind of go over the scope of a standing committee and really what kind of issues we're going to be looking at on a kind of a long-term basis. So I think that point's very well taken. Thank you. Do we have any further questions for each other, for the developers, for us? Great. Okay, well, at this time, we wanted to open it up for public and member comment. I know we have some other people besides committee members and developers on the call, so we'll open it up. Operator, could you please open it up? Operator?
Didn't hear any. At this time, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. And there are no questions at this time.
Great. Thank you very much. Well, at this time, we'll go into our next steps. We have another Q&A call scheduled for February 19th, and this is one where we'll have distributed the TEP evaluation summary to you prior to that call, and we have asked members of the TEP to be available on that call to answer questions about their evaluation. So, again, we will have further opportunities to ask questions about the measure specifications, about the review process, and then, again, about the TEP evaluation. So that's the next step. We have our in-person meeting March 4th and 5th here in Washington, D.C. If you've not received the logistics already, you should be receiving them shortly for your to reserve your hotel room and to book your travel. We look forward to seeing all of you out here. We think this is going to be a great meeting. We're looking forward to kind of the, again, as we mentioned earlier, the scope of the standing committee. This is new for us, and we're really excited about the opportunities this raises to really have ownership over a portfolio of measures. So, again, we want to thank the developers for being present on this call and graciously answering questions, and for the committee members who were able to ask questions today, we thank you very much. So this will conclude the call, and thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.